turn it over to Miri to kind of chair our session.
Okay.
I suppose you should introduce yourself. So
okay. Well, I'm Miri Freud-Kandel, a lecturer in modern Judaism at the Center for Hebrew and Jewish Studies here in Oxford. I've been coordinating these seminars with Frank, and I think hopefully they have been so far a worthwhile venture, which we hope to continue. We are very honoured today to be able to welcome Professor Julia Slipner from Cambridge, and hopefully in due course Dr. Norman Solomon as well. Professor Lipner is a very recognised scholar from Cambridge University, expert in Hinduism, who has published numerous books, which I won't go into now. And he has proposed this topic of the truths of translation, which we hope is a useful topic for us to look at from both the Jewish and Hindu perspective as part of our efforts to try and use this forum for dialogue to try and gain better understandings from within the faith traditions that we're examining, as well as in broader terms. So I think we'll start now with
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this invitation. I'm very glad to be here. I came last evening to give a lecture and then staying on to do this seminar. So it's been a very good experience so far. I'm sorry for all of you because my colleague hasn't turned up, and I was looking forward so much to meeting him and having this dialogue with him and extending the conversation. So if half of you wish to get up and walk away, I can understand. I can understand that. But if not, then thank you for your patience. And I'm particularly sorry because I'm going to say something about translation in a Hindu context. But really, this is by way of preliminary. What translation means, what translation is all about, what kind of models of translation we might use in order to effect a good translation, what counts for a good translation. These are some of the issues that I want to be raising today, and be very interested to hear your background. So I'll try and dig a bit deep because I'm hoping to change what passes for a rather superficial understanding of translation in many people's minds. So without more ado, let me, I've got a lot of material here, and if Norman doesn't turn up, I might encroach on his time, but we'll see.
Go to see if I can.
Okay, well, I'll read and I'll speak as I go along, but I do hope that the wide net that I'm casting will be of use to people from both who are interested in both Hindu and Jewish traditions, because we all have to cope with the reality of translation. So by translation, I don't mean in the first instance what we may call the narrower meaning of the term, that is, the conveying of semantic content from one written or spoken tongue to another. To be sure, this is the most obvious sense of translation, and I do not exclude it. It will occupy a fair amount of our attention in this paper. But let me start by saying how exposed we are to the ubiquity of translation. I mean, especially in this narrow sense, in circumstances that range from the mundane to the more sublime. Anything from the array of languages on a packet of detergent, all purporting to give the same directions for use, or the subtitles in a Bollywood movie, to the conversion from one language to another of a literary text. These are all examples of translation in the narrow sense of the term. And the sheer momentum of living in an increasingly interactive global environment marked by a bewildering diversity of linguistic backgrounds seems to produce this growing demand for the translation of different genres of text. But this is only a surface display of translation. a token of a deeper meaning of the term. And so my first meaning of the term translation is the passage of a set of developing and defining cultural traits and themes via the undercurrents of more or less distant stretches of space and time. It is thus that we can say, however elusively, that a particular mindset is currently Western rather than Islamic, traditionally English rather than Bengali. Such affirmations of identity, the end result of a chain of historical transactions, conceptual shapings and linguistic determinations between peoples, are the product of translation too. The translation of carrying across, translatio, transferre, to carry across, of a set of enduring cultural specifics from past times through to the present. So we are the inheritors now of a pattern, of a set of cultural traits, of ways of thinking, of ways of acting, which are the result of translation. Translation through history of the currents in which we find ourselves. That is an act of translation. The translation of foundational texts that go back hundreds of years, which have produced the kind of mindsets and patterns of thinking that we operate within here and now. So that is the first sense of translation that I'm talking about. And all the senses that I talk about are interrelated, so they're not disjointed. It is important to note, given the vagaries of the geographical and linguistic transactions between peoples through time, even within a particular cultural circumference, that the fixing of a mindset by means of the carrying over, translation, of certain specifics relies inevitably on the translation in the first sense of foundational texts. Weltanschauungen, worldviews, philosophical preoccupations down the ages, the very shape of cultural assumptions, notwithstanding their thematic and other variations amid a diversity of linguistic and ethnic identities, derive from the translation, the carrying over of the formulated experience of Ur texts, foundational texts across internal and external linguistic boundaries. This involves the sometimes not inconsiderable changes over time of word and meaning within a particular tongue, as well as the divisions that characterize historically closely related languages. So I've distinguished two senses of translation. One is the fairly superficial and obvious one, translating from one literary text to another. The other is more deep than that. That is the translating, the carrying over hundreds of years of core ideas, cultural traits, cultural specifics from foundational texts in a particular culture, so that we operate within the circumference of those texts, so that we can say this is an Islamic text, this is a Hindu text, this is a Jewish text, this is a rabbinic text. We can't even begin to speak in terms of such identities unless these cultural traits and specifics across linguistic and other boundaries have been taking place for hundreds of years. So those are the two senses. But now I want to even go into a deeper sense of the term translation. There is an even more grounded sense of the word translation for our purposes. And this pertains to the way the brain acquires, collates, and processes its sensory and other input. That translation that bridges the gap between the transmission of external data and their internal reception, and to the way the mind then experiences and seeks to communicate semantic content. This calls for a mode of translation as well. The communication of individual meaning in a particular instance, in conversation, through a gesture, in written form, is enabled by the shaping of meaningful content selected from a vast matrix of banked material in which the mind's various capacities, memory, imagination, intelligence, education, and so on, all have their integral roles to play. And this arises by means of a twofold conditioning, the one generic, the other individual. The first derives from the cultural circumference out of which one speaks, the specific mindset determined by a particular culture or subculture. So we can say things like, spoken like a true Englishman, or spoken like a true New Yorker, or whatever. And the second arises from within the circumscription, the individuated expression of a particular life history. Ah, it is Miri who speaks. So our utterances are complexioned by this twofold determination. We do not, we cannot jump out of our cognitive skins in the conveying of meaning. And there is a double hiatus, a double gap here as well. First, the hiatus between experiencing, feeling, knowing what it is we wish to communicate and the actual expression of this content. How often we experience frustration at being unable to translate, that is, to actualize the felt or mental content of personal formulated experience, in being at a loss for words, not because we have nothing to say, but because we do not have the words at hand to say it. We are unable to translate what we feel, think, know into the adequacy of semantic content. And this will have a very important trait of translation at the third level, which I shall come to. But beyond this, there remains the added problem of transferring individuated meaning across personal boundaries from self to self. Have we been effective in getting ourselves understood, we may ask, in translating meaning from one personal nexus to another? At this point, perhaps it is worth clarifying that for our purposes, the semantic unit of translation in its most obvious sense is the sentence, rather than the phoneme or verbal root or the etymon or the term and so on. In other words, by sentence in this discussion, I understand the minimal quantum of meaning in any context purporting to make coherent sense. This quantum of meaning need not be conveyed by a plurality of words. It may be expressed by a single word, for example, yes, yes, that is, yes, it is raining, or magenta, that is, I prefer the magenta one, or by a single meaningful gesture. So the unit of translation is a sentence in this sense, which means the minimal quantum of meaning in any context purporting to make coherent sense. Now, it is not difficult to grasp that all three strata of translation are structurally connected. The most grounded level of receiving external data and internalizing it, the second level of transmitting cultural traits and specifics based on foundational text through the passage of history, and the third level of actually using all this information to translate a text from Sanskrit or Hebrew into English, say. All these three levels are grounded and are interconnected. And you can't understand the topmost level, about which I shall say much more, unless you understand what's going on in the deeper levels. We cannot satisfactorily translate the Greek of Plato into English or the Sanskrit of Kalidasa into German unless we have first contextualized Plato or Kalidasa in terms of received cultural idioms with respect to ancient Greek and modern English, or classical Sanskrit and contemporary German. And we could not do this without allowing for the limitations and possibilities in conveying meaning of what we might call the idiolects of individual translators, the individual language that each translator speaks as that individual, irrespective of the language that he uses, the tongue that he uses. Over a century ago, a Jowett would translate the same extract of Plato into English rather differently from a Cornford of a later generation, though each attempt might be considered a satisfactory translation in this way. So thus far we might say that our discussion points to a tripartite truth of translation, irrespective of the stratum, one of these three layers being considered. First, truth, its inherent possibility. Translation is possible from thought to speech, from one human tongue to another. And I'm going to argue that this must be the case. It's not an accident. To be a human being means that you can translate from one tongue to another. Of course, you must have the competence to do so. Number two, nevertheless, translation carries a stamp of incommensurability. There will always be a gap. This is because of its hiatal nature. Ontically, translation resists closure. This raises the question as to what adequate translation might be. And three, notwithstanding its intrinsic possibility and incommensurability, or rather in the attempt to reconcile these two extremes, translation becomes inherently creative. It engenders a new self, a reflected other. Now let me explain these three points. Translation as epistemic act. In an early lecture when discussing Descartes and Foucault's understanding of madness vis-à-vis the role of rational discourse or the play of logos, Jacques Derrida observed, quote, that if discourse and philosophical communication, that is language itself, are to have an intelligible meaning, that is to say, if they are to conform to their essence and vocation as discourse, they must simultaneously in fact and in principle escape madness. They must carry normality within themselves, for this belongs to the meaning of meaning. By essence, the sentence is normal. It carries normality within it, that is, sense in every sense of the word, Descartes in particular, unquote. This is probably the only paragraph in the whole corpus of Derrida that I understand. In a community of human beings, however primitive, who express forms of solidarity among themselves by formulating rites of passage, acquiring and storing food and information, devising means of shared entertainment, and reproducing and otherwise perpetuating their identity as a community, there can be no such thing as a monadic language, a language so private that it remains essentially incommunicable beyond the group. As human beings, the group are subject to the same natural laws that govern other human groups elsewhere in the world, in terms of which body and mind need to develop and reach out as human. To use Derrida's famous concept, the difference between this group and others cannot be impervious per se, insofar as the groups are characterized as human. It is in this sense that the language of our group is inherently normal. Normal not only for carrying out the transactions of everyday life within the group, but normal also insofar as it is the inalienable vehicle for conducting transactions that are human. Such a system of transactions can only be carried out in terms of a stable logic that is recognizable as such, that is, in terms of a rationality. In this context, madness, the realm of the irrational, becomes the limiting symbol of quotidian normality. A universal point is being made here about the nature of formulated human experience and the communication of semantic content. It is the foundational point implicit in the raison d'etre of anthropology and ethnology as social scientific disciplines, not to mention cognitive and other forms of psychology. More romantically, it underlies the unquenchable thirst of human beings down the ages to penetrate other cultures and even to dominate them, not only or primarily by force of arms, but by the manipulation of meaning. As to the last, this is exactly what the colonial project was all about. Theoretically, there are no no-go areas, no hermetic boundaries in the transmission and comprehension of human meaning. And so it is that the resourceful continue to, in search of Rosetta Stones of one sort or another, either between different tongues or between fields of learning, and comparative philologists still strive to decipher the Indus Valley script of the second millennium BCE, one of the last barriers to a fuller understanding of a great and ancient civilization. This understanding of human speech is predicated on the ineluctable assumption that language is the expression of a collective self in the first instance, in and through which the individual self is shaped, that, in other words, human beings are intrinsically relational beings. Today, this intuitive truth derives support not only from the accumulated wisdom of the comparative study of various civilizations, but also from ongoing scientific research. Further, it extends to the awareness that it is language in its various agencies that constructs both the collective and the individual self in their societal context. But where there is construction of meaning, there is the contingency of contextuality and the temporality of interpretation. So once you've got these three levels of translation, the grounded level of making sense of what we receive from outside, the second level of transmission of meaning across centuries and creating specific cultures, and the third meaning of actually using language to translate into something, one language into another. And once you've got these three characteristics of translation, its inherent possibility as a human act, secondly, its incommensurability, the whole question of adequacy of translation, and the third thing, the creativity of translation. Once you've got all these things there, you have interpretation. It is inherent to human language that it is susceptible of interpretation, of numerous meanings. You cannot operate in terms of the normative meaning, the normative sense, generally, certainly not in a literary text, because there are all these depths, so that even the author of a text need not be aware of the depths of authorial meaning, and I'll come to that presently. So the point I'm going to develop now is the point of the incommensurability of translation. The gaps, in other words, in translating. The articulation of self to own self and to self as other, both collective and individual, in their historical unfolding, necessitates the deployment of a hermeneutic of meaning. The life growth of the individual as self-aware, the development of the collective, cannot be achieved without a complex dialectic of interpretation, which becomes possible only through a corresponding development of complexity in the formation and use of language. The very multi-layeredness of language, and here I include gestures and wordless signs, gives ample scope to the ambiguities of intentionality, which are being explored so well through modern literary and critical theory. But to speak of the inevitability of interpretation in the transmission of meaning, of the inherent multi-layeredness and intentional ambiguity of language, is to speak of translation as an exercise in incommensurability. In other words, though the translation of meaning across internal and external barriers of articulation may be inherently possible wherever there is human speech, it cannot be achieved perfectly in terms of some exact match of synonymity. And this requires further elucidation. I'm here quoting from Steiner. Steiner says, a perfect act of translation would be one of total synonymity. It would presume an interpretation so precisely exhaustive as to leave no single unit in the source text, phonetic, grammatical, semantic, contextual, out of complete account, and yet so calibrated as to have added nothing in the way of paraphrase, explication, or variant. But we know that in practice, this perfect fit is possible neither at the stage of interpretation nor at that of linguistic transfer and restatement, unquote. Not only in practice, but also in principle, is what I say. Not only for contingent reasons, that is, the linguistic deficiencies of the translator, confusions or obscurities in the source text, but because of the nature of translation as such, we could not achieve a perfect fit even under optimal conditions. This is my point. And this is the incommensurability of translation. And the reason for this resides in the ontic uniqueness of each individual's formulation of experience. This uniqueness extends to each stratum of translation distinguished above. The assimilation and storing of information is conditioned by the individuality of one's experiential faculties. There is only one perspective on the world in the name of Miri Freud Kangler, a singular composite of shaped and initiating consciousness of a particular history of psychophysical conditioning. Consequently, her attempted translations and their idiosyncratic limitations of formulated experience into word and gesture will also be unique. This applies both to the conversion of experience from mind-brain to intentional sign, whether this be by word or gesture, and to the translation of meaning across personal hiatuses that are external, from own self to self as other. But we may ask, is not this originality ironed out in the daily interchanges of a shared language, in the common currency of words and ideas by which we relate to one another? If uniqueness held sway and acted as a barrier to successful communication, how could we affect the fruitful cognitive interchanges of an increasingly globalized world? Doubtless, the transmission of meaning could take place only on the basis of shared semantic content. In this sense, cognitive universals are a requisite for verbal self-expression and communication. But such universals are only the raw material, so to speak, of meaningful interaction. For it is individuals who transmit meaning, who act in terms of their own particularity of context and experience, on the semantic template handed on to them and then passed on. Just as the various items of the coinage of a land remain inert, in potentia as it were, until they are subsumed as the active ingredients of endless unique interchanges of greater or lesser worth between persons, so the cognitive universals of which we speak enter into the common currency of unique transactions of meaningful expression between individuals. So what I'm getting at here is that however much we use cognitive universals, however much we use universal ideas in exchanging semantic content between each other, and we must do it, we always stamp these cognitive universals with our unique interpretations of meaning. And that is why in the transfer of meaning from one unique human being to another, which has been uniquely shaped, there must always be a loss of semantic content when I'm transmitting meaning from one to the other. Now, all these things come into effect when a translator translates a literary text into another text. A, because you cannot delve into, you cannot adequately understand or comprehend the depth of nuances and meaning of the source text, and B, because you yourself are unique in this attempt to translate meaning. And also the source text, as I'll go on to point out, has words and semantic content which carry the weight, the momentum of centuries of history. You can't take all this out. You can't mine all this material in one act of translation. So we're still talking now about the incommensurability of the epistemic act of translation. I'm leaving out big chunks, I'm afraid, of this paper, so here and there I could say much more on these individual points. This is why no two concatenations of meaning that represent the translation of the same passage from one language to another in different hands can ever be the same. Each sums up a unique resolution of meaning across internal and external hiatuses of space and time in different individuals. From the point of view of the philosophy of translation, it is not a trivial matter that there is only ever one of each of us. Thus, translation as a linguistic form resists semantic closure. Translation is always open-ended. You can always produce a new translation of the same text. In fact, that is the momentum of translation. There is no such thing as the definitive translation of any particular text. Its hiatal nature urges continually towards the breakthrough, straining to the limits of meaning, encouraging the stretching and play of words. Curiously, or perhaps not, it is in the attempt to translate certain forms of scripture that one encounters a recognition of translation's ontic resistance to closure. This can occur in a number of ways, and I give some examples. Consider the case of the Quran. Translation of the Quran, says a Muslim expert, I quote, has often been hampered by theological hesitations about the translatability of God's word. Three such hesitations may be identified. Firstly, for the theologians, the Quran is inimitable. Since this quality pertains to its Arabic diction as well as to its meaning, no translation can be said adequately to represent or represent the original. Secondly, the Muslim belief that earlier scriptures had been compromised by interpolation and distortion, tahrif, led many to defend God's book from the tradutore, the translator, who might turn traditore, the traitor. And thirdly, 20th century Arab theologians sometimes feared that translation into European languages would entail a diminution of the religion's perceived Arab particularity, leading to its symbolic conquest by the colonialist other, unquote. Let us consider another interestingly different instance of incommensurability in the translation of scripture. And this pertains to the Vedas, canonical Sanskrit scriptures of the Hindus. Scholars date the ongoing redaction of the four Vedas from about 1200 BCE to about the beginning of the Common Era. But traditional Hindu theologians believed and believe that the Vedas are timeless. This timelessness does not necessarily refer to the reception of the Vedic text among humans, but to the composition of the Vedas and to their Sanskritic literary form. As such, the Vedas are supposed to be apaurusheya, that is, not composed by any personal agent, which includes any deity. This means that the sequence of Sanskrit words that makes up the Vedas as a whole is autonomous, timeless and unchanging. Their Sanskritic utterance in certain circumstances has the power to produce and change the reality or aspects thereof of our world. Now, traditional Hindu theologians were not particularly perturbed by attempts to translate the meaning of Vedic passages. Here they continually resorted to paraphrase, restatement, commentary. It was just that Vedic Sanskrit was a privileged scriptural language because it was its utterance in certain circumstances that had effective power with respect to the production and change of being. In this sense, the Vedas were unique and untranslatable into other verbal expressions, including the Sanskritic. Though the Vedas represent a form of intelligible discourse and have been subjected to numerous translations into various languages, it was primarily their utterance in their correct context and sequence that was sacrosanct and effective, not the meanings. In this sense, it is not clear if we are dealing with an instance of untranslatability proper. But insofar as their meanings were sought to be transferred across the linguistic boundaries we have been considering, they too fall under the inherent limitations of translation per se. So we looked at the way two scriptures, the Quran and the Vedas, in Islam and in Hinduism, can be said to be untranslatable, but in interestingly different ways. Now just look briefly at the Bible, or more precisely the New Testament, in the hands of Christian missionaries. Whatever literary judgments may have been made over the centuries about the inimitable beauty and power of God's Word in the form of the Bible, there have been no major theological objections to translating it. The Bible has never been faced with objections to translation, certainly not the New Testament. On the contrary, one of the first things missionaries contemplate when encountering a new language or unevangelized people is the translation of biblical text into this new context. The narrative of Christian expansion is replete with this endeavor. Indeed, important advances in the history of printing and the formation of various scripts and their grammar can be attributed to this program of translating the Bible. So, the truth of the Quran and the Vedas for the eyes of faith apart, is it not the case that the truth of the New Testament is constituted only in and through its very translatability. And yet it is through this compelling feature in the ceaseless striving for adequate reformulation and restatement that the Bible's truth must remain, humanly speaking, ever unfulfilled and elusive. Thus, the translator deals in approximations. And from one point of view, the task is to narrow the gaps to the best of one's ability, to be ever sensitive to context and valence, to what might be lost in the cognitive silences between words. I now want to talk about the creational dimension of translation. As I said, that translation is inherently possible. By the nature of the human condition, there can be no such thing as an untranslatable language. Every language, if it is a language where one speaks to another, must be translatable. Point two, nevertheless, there are gaps. And I've been speaking about the cognitive silences between words. So there is an element of incommensurability. But number three, this allows translation to be creative, to produce a reflected self in the act of translation, which is extremely important for the continuation of our human experience. And that's what I'm going to concentrate on now in this section of the paper. So much for the incommensurability of the translational act. But it is this hiatal characteristic that gives another dimension to translation, enabling it to exploit these very silences between words in creative ways, and rendering the good translator one of the most valuable assets in the enriching of human speech and experience. It always bugs me whenever you see texts where a translation has occurred, that it seems to be somehow diminished in the publishing world or in the scholarly world, translated by, or also. It is one of the most creative and important acts of human discourse, the whole process of good translation. And without translation, what I'm doing now is to engage, just to talk to you in English, is to engage in a threefold structure of translation. I've received data, I've internalized data, I've translated it into myself, into my personality, into my individuality. I've received data that goes back hundreds, sometimes thousands of years from different cultures, which shapes, which has been translated through time, undergone so many changes. And now I am speaking to you and communicating to you with the stamp of individuality in a universal context. This is no mean achievement. And we all do this at different levels of our existence. So, it is this demiurgic property of translation, this creative activity of translation, that we now turn to in the third and final part of this discussion. Dryden's observation in the preface to his translation of the Aeneid is well known. I quote, he said, "I've endeavored to make Virgil speak such English as he himself would have spoken if he had been born in England and in this present age," unquote. Of course, if Virgil had been born in England in Dryden's age, not only would there have been no Aeneid, but there's a good chance that the very course of the history of Western literature, and perhaps more significantly, of certain deep-set features of Western culture, would have taken a very different turn. And that's the point I'm making. The fact that the Aeneid is one of the foundational texts of Western culture in producing a certain mindset which have been translated across peoples and languages for hundreds of years means that it could not have been produced in Dryden's age and time. The whole concept of the Aeneid would have not existed. For may not the Aeneid be regarded as one of those foundational texts whose verbal and conceptual translations down the ages have played an important part in giving shape to Western perceptions of the world? Perhaps Dryden's point could have been expressed more pithily in the words of Ronald Knox, quote, "A good translation should have the freshness of an original product." I've now come to the third and in one sense the most superficial layer of translation, with which we are all familiar, translating a text from one language to another. We speak of a good translation here. In the same essay, Knox distinguishes between the artisans and the craftsmen of translation, that is, between the jobbing carpenters of the art, those producers of subtitles and directions for use, the pure functionalists, and the Chippendales of translation, those who are, quote, concerned to produce something useful but not merely functional. The rendering, like the original, is to be a literary production, unquote. His focus is on the craftsman, and so is ours. In a lecture entitled Reflections of a Translator, an interesting title, Professor Nicholas Delange, a colleague at Cambridge, speaks of three models of a translator. The first is the translator as mere copyist. Here the translator seeks to imitate the original as faithfully as possible, the result intended being, quote, like the reproductions of paintings and artifacts that you can buy in museum shops, unquote. Clearly, there can be no freshness of product here. And if this is all that a translator sets out to accomplish, it is arguable that the vitality, the distinguishing feature of the original, must be lost. In seeking to duplicate, the translator comes up with a crib, with all the dismembering of the original that this term entails. Where translation is concerned, the attempt to duplicate can only result, ironically, in translation as glaring approximation between original and copy. This is not what good translation is about. So much for the model of the translator as copyist. Secondly, there is the model of the translator as servant. Here the job... Norman, welcome.
You finish and then take a little break and then...
Oh, I can't start again. You and I would forget what I've said beforehand. It's a bit complicated.
So when you're done, we'll take a little break and then...
Okay, right. Right. So you'll have to hang on, Norman. I'm very glad to see you here, but I'm in full flow right now,
yes,
so I'll just carry on.
Yes.
Right. Secondly, I'm talking about three models of the translator somewhere into my talk. The first was the translator as copyist, which we have somewhat dismissed. The second, there's the model of the translator as servant. Here, the job of the translator is to work, quote from Delange, completely unnoticed, like the perfect butler, unquote. According to Professor Delange, the weakness of this approach is, quote, that the successful translator is the one who has eradicated from his text every arresting feature, every sign of originality. Is that really what we want from our translators? Do we want Dante or Kafka to read like the latest pulp novel? Unquote. For my part, I see the point of the distinction between these two models, copyist servant and copyist, as that between soulless externalizer and internalizer. The copyist has not entered the heart of the original, so that there is no dialogue between subject and object. Consequently, there is only objectification of the original, and the translation dies the death of inanity. In the case of the perfect servant, however, the translator internalizes the original to such an extent as to be completely immersed in it, surrendering every vestige of subjectivity. The objectification here is of the translator, with equally ineffectual results for the translation. In neither case is there that meeting of hearts and minds in the interaction between original and product that is the prerequisite of a good translation. And finally, Professor Delange introduces the model of the translator as creative artist, whose role is rather that, quote, of a poet or novelist who takes an incident or an idea and works it into an original and exciting piece of writing, unquote. According to Professor Delange, this is unsatisfactory too, if it is held up as the sole ideal of what translation must be. For what is invariably lacking here is that mark of fidelity to the original, so essential for a good translation. We are not unfamiliar with translations in this mold, where the translator has taken such liberties with the text as to have produced not a fresh piece of work, in every sense of this word, but virtually a new creation. This too is to fail, in my view, in the act of translation. In terms of our earlier analysis, it is to submerge the objectivity of the original, its inalienable givenness, in the voracious subjectivity of the renderer, who becomes one who rends, disembowels, and tears up, so as to make of the original an ingested non-entity in the translational act. As a separate work of creativity, it may be highly commendable, but as a work of translation, it is an act of perfidy. Traduttore here has turned traditore. The ideal for Professor Delange is to blend all three models of translation. The good translator, he says, must be copyist, servant, and creative writer. The trick is a balancing trick, to succeed in all three at once. I would liken the translator to a performing musician. Unquote. So the translator must be attuned to the original so as to enter into a double relationship and a double responsibility, to the composer on the one hand and to his listeners on the other. Unquote. From what has been said so far, we may conclude that there are three salient characteristics of the good translation. The good translator, good translation, good translator. One, fidelity to, and two, respect for the original, and three, integrity between original and product. All the marks of good translation analyzed hitherto are summed up in these three qualities, and the supervening model here, in my view, is that of the translator as, and I will use a Sanskrit term, suhrid, pronounced as I've said it. Suhrid is a Sanskrit term that is itself hard to translate. The suhrid is a friend, a confidant, a well-wisher, something of a soulmate. And that is what a translator must be to the text that he or she translates. Now, if I can have just 10 minutes more to speak of suhridic translation. There are no clocks. Yeah, don't have eyes in the back of my head as yet. Right. In 10 minutes, I hope to finish. In a way, suhridic translation is an act of midwifery, displaying through the passage, all these midwifery terms, displaying through the passage of restatement what was sometimes only germinally present in the original. It is an act of enablement which gives new life, freshness, to what was already there. In this way, semantic content is not transgressed but reborn, renewed. And this process seems to be twofold. First, a striving to enter into the heart of the source text. One can do this only by submerging the ego self, by bringing all one's skills into play, linguistic, psychological, noetic, in exploring context and intention. It is important to note that authorial intention does not exhaust the intentionality of the source text. Authorial intention can be unclear, both to author and to reader, stratified, explicit and implicit, at odds with itself. In his stimulating work, Translation and Understanding, Sukanta Chowdhury points out that, I quote, "Translation can release an alternative, subversive potential of the text, turn it inside out to bring its deconstructive factor to the fore. The new language draws out possibilities beyond the original writer's intention or awareness, possibilities he might have consciously rejected. Going beyond authorial intention, there might be possibilities that his own language could not admit, but that are instilled in the new text by the structures of the target or host language." Unquote. So this respectful, explorative journey into the source text, attentive to its intentionalities, context, resonances, achieved both by the subjection of the ego and by giving it rein to enact the modalities of the text, I shall call the phase of kenotic interrogation. It requires an emptying, a pouring out of the translator's self, the assumption of an actor's role. The translator must, in fact, get inside somebody else's skin before he undertakes the rendering of a single sentence. Ronald Knox says that all translation is a kind of impersonation. Make a success of that, and style and idiom will follow, unquote. Here the translator has taken on the identity of the text. But this is only one limb of the dialectic. The next limb is faithful restatement. If the translator remains in kenotic mode, the amity of the relationship between translator and text will be impaired. For friendship requires a dialogue between individuals. Good translation is not a crib. As Chowdhury's statement indicates, it releases the original without distorting it. In the second limb of the dialectic, the subjectivity of the translator is engaged, and the material absorbed in the first phase by immersion is released through the personality, the idiolect of the translator. Good translation entails a dynamic equilibrium between kenosis and plenitude, between emptying out and reissuing, through the fullness of the translator's skill and individuality. If you wish to frame it musically, in the hands of a Toscanini or a Simon Rattle, Beethoven's seventh will sound recognizably the same, down to the last note if they work to the same score. Yet each rendering will take on a life of its own, and neither would be what Beethoven himself could hear in his mind's ear. Now I'm going to condense drastically, I'm afraid, that I've given some examples of translation from the Sanskrit, what would count in my view as a crib and what would count as a good translation, but I shall have to pass over that and then just speak now of the historicity of translation to end this particular discourse. So the ideal, we have argued, can be approximated, the ideal of translation, only more or less perfectly. And it is in the cognitive silences between the equilibrating poles of this integrity of translation that the creative resonances of translation reside, where the tension between fidelity and respect releases the multivalent potential of the source text, of the semantic content in new form, of the play and stretching of words. Chowdhury mentions some of these possible acquisitions. I quote, "In translation, the verbal transference carries its own disjunctive function, makes the translation something other than the original, reveals in the original the potential to be something other than itself. Each translation from a marginal or subaltern language into a dominant one can counter the imbalance between the dominant language and its subaltern counterpart, often subtly, sometimes dramatically. It validates the subaltern culture quite literally in terms of the dominant one, but thereby draws out the dominant language beyond its entrenched confines." So, the final point I'm making now is on the relationship between dominant language and subaltern languages in the process of translation. And I want to say that it's not always as one-sided as you might expect, because sometimes translating from a subaltern language into a dominant one affirms the integrity and the identity and preserves the identity of the subaltern language. I just want to make a point on that. Translation is embedded in historicity. It is a salient marker of historical transience. For every translation, by virtue of its contingency as this translation, this concatenation of words rather than some other, demonstrates its contingency. By its vulnerability to time and change, translation, like history, shows not only how the world came to be what it is, but also how close at times it came to be quite different. That's the point. This translation could have been a little different from another. It shows up the contingency of the world in which we live. Translations, however good they might be, cannot mark time. They are harbingers of change, of a continuous process of retranslation, of the rebirth of texts and ideas. And this has repercussions for languages and cultures that may have a history of subalternity. Through translation, the subaltern of today can become, if not the hegemon, then the resistant interlocutor of tomorrow. I'm not sure we can call Bengali a subaltern language. You will all speak Bengali in heaven. But anyway, it has a colonial history. Yet it is spoken today in its various forms by many millions of people. It has produced a Bankim Chandra Chatterjee, the first to develop the novel form in an Indian language, and a Nobel laureate, albeit in translation, in Rabindranath Tagore. Nevertheless, it would be fair to say, I think, that to a Eurocentric West or an Anglophilic world, because English, of course, is now the dominant language of our world, it remains a closed, somewhat marginal language. Translations, good translations of literary works from Bengali into English, therefore, will perform a dual function. On the one hand, they will valorize Bengali language and culture as the vehicle of a refined humanity which has many fresh things to say about the enrichment of human relationships, about how to assume fruitful new perspectives on the world. They also help us reveal those cultural differences that define and at the same time celebrate the particularities of certain kinds of identity. All this will encourage some to learn Bengali, not least in the universities, with serious intent, and many to hold on to their linguistic heritage in the face of a mounting, omnivorous challenge from English. But on the other hand, these translations will also bring about a change for the good in English. They will serve the dominant language. They will insinuate new thought and life into English-based perceptions, new loan words, new cultural idioms. Through this exchange in time, English will be changed forever as part of the broadening global interactions between peoples. One must not underestimate the constructive value of good translation. I will leave it at that for the time being. I have another 10 pages to go, but these are many of them are examples and so on, and I think that the essence of what I want to say has been said. So thank you very much.
Firstly, Professor Lima, thank you very much for an incredibly enlightening, creative talk. We now have the pleasure of
changed places.
Introducing.
I thought we were to have a coffee break first, actually.
Ah, we're going to. That's
my
true.
Understanding.
No, it actually, it won't be ready until 3:45.
Ah, so oh, so well, God.
It looks like you might have to
stop. Mind wired.
Yeah, of course, yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
So I'll take this opportunity to introduce Dr. Norman Solomon, the Emeritus Fellow in